All right. Thank you, Dan, and thank you for the opportunity to speak here to present some of my work. I suppose this is going to be somewhat a change of pace for some of you, because I'm not going to talk about dark matter or indirect detection itself, rather about the backgrounds, which I still think is very important. So let's start with the positrons, as Dan said. And I suppose most of you have noticed that there has been a big announcement a couple of weeks ago by the PIM of the AMS collaboration at CERN, mid-April, I believe. And this talk was really hyped up before. Some people even talked about Sam Ting would unveil the nature of dark matter, which of course already at the time was actually a seeing thing of doesn't mean it's dark matter. And that's what I'm going to talk about in the first part of my talk. So here's the positron fraction, basically the ratio of the flux of positrons to the total electron positron flux, with a couple of other measurements in the last years by Pamela and Fermi. And see, the accuracy of data is really quite remarkable. Fermi not so much, but this experiment, of course, wasn't designed to measure positrons and electrons separately. So by some ingenious method using the Earth magnetic field, they were still able to distinguish them and basically confirm the rise before the AMS measurement came out. So what you can see is that the positron fraction is falling at low energies, what you would expect in your simplest diffusive model. These positrons are simply produced as secondary particles by spallation of so-called primary cosmic rays of protons and nuclei on the gas in the galaxy. They have a softer spectrum than the primary particles, so their ratio should be falling. But then, beyond energies of a few GeV or so, the positron fraction turns out to be rising. So the interpretation is there must be an additional harder source of positrons. But I believe there have been a couple of misconceptions, in particular after the announcement of the AMS results, and I'm going to challenge some of these misconceptions for you the next couple of slides. First one is the positron fraction is turning over, so it must be dark matter. So what do I mean by that? First of all, what even the AMS collaboration put some emphasis on is that the slope of the rise of the positron fraction is decreasing with energy by about an order of magnitude between tens of GeV and the highest data point at 350 GeV. But for some people, that's not enough. Some people have to extrapolate the positron fraction beyond the data that have actually been presented. So what they did is they looked at the talk, looked at the event displays that were presented, said, well, this must clearly be the highest energies, otherwise why wouldn't I have shown that? They take the number of positrons in the highest bin, extrapolate that to zero at the highest energy, and here's what they find. The positron fraction is turning over really sharply. Lugos?
That's insane.
Thank you. So in any case, I think the reasoning behind it turning over, so it must be dark matter, is that astrophysical sources oftentimes come with exponential cutoffs simply from the fact that the escape times or cooling times or escape rates and cooling rates are proportional to the particle density in the sources. So you'd also expect to find a exponential cutoff on the positron fraction. But of course, that's only true at source. So this is only the positron fraction at the source, not necessarily what we observe at Earth, because in between you have propagation, particular energy losses. And in the simplest model, in this Thomson regime, where the energy loss rate is proportional to the energy square, you can see that the energy loss of high energy particles is much more severe than low energy particles. So effectively, you're compressing the spectrum, and you're getting something that's sharper than exponential cutoff after propagation. Now, to make this point a bit more quantitative, I've come up with a very simple toy model. You have a power law background for the secondary positrons produced during the propagation of primary cosmic rays. You have an electron spectrum that is about e to minus 3, which is very much consistent with observations. And then you add one single source, either at 100, 300, or 500 parsec. You adjust the parameters. Actually, all these sources have a spectral index of 1.7, cutoff at 3 TeV, which doesn't make a huge difference here. And then you just adjust the normalization of these sources and the ages. You can see you basically get whatever you want. Either the positron fraction is rising beyond the data, the highest energy. It's cutting off, or it's cutting even off very sharply if the source is very old and relatively far away. The second point, or the second misconception, is the positron fraction has substructure, so it must be dark matter. And again, I think the idea is that you have a more complex dark matter sector. All the dark matter particles are annihilating somehow to leptons, and you get substructure. Now, if you look at the data, that's actually not what you see. The residuals are very much in agreement with zero within the error bars with this simple toy model. Even if you zoom into higher energies, you don't see that much. Well, some people have argued there's some coherent structure. Maybe there's a bump here. There's a very sharp feature here. There's a more extended bump here. We can play devil's advocate and just...
Okay, so those are, yeah, are correlated, right?
Okay. They are correlated to a certain degree. Only, yeah, so you would... You would expect that nearby error bars, like neighbors, would be correlated, but you wouldn't, for example, expect that an error bar here is necessarily correlated with that.
You could just compare the energy resolution rate, quote, for example, with this, and I mean, the binning is sufficiently large
Well, at least we know that from similar experiments like PAMLA, they have done analysis, as Dan said. I think in the paper that AMS put out, they haven't given enough details to actually check that and haven't really shown the energy resolution as a function of energy.
Well, they quote it and say that it's within 1%
accuracy. Oh, yeah, but they don't show it as a function of energy. So they show an average, they quote an average.
It's a function of energy.
Okay.
Now this statement of the chart is possible, right? I thought that the substructure is more like the pulsars or something.
That's exactly the point I'm getting at. But some people have argued substructure could be due to dark matter. Small bumps, for example, on top of an astrophysically explained rise of the positron fraction could be due to dark matter. But that's exactly the point I wanted to make. So let's lower the normalization of the astrophysical explanation, and of course now you can get some excesses, but again you can play around with the astrophysical sources, just vary the parameters like spectral indices, distances, times, and what you get is basically something, all kinds of shapes. You can get something rather broad like here, you can something very sharp going up to high energies, cutting off very sharply to intermediate energies. Basically I think the astrophysical explanations are always much more flexible because you get many more sources at your disposal. You can basically fit hundreds of bumps if you like.
Don't these sharp examples also screw up the smoothness of the Fermi electron plus positron spectrum?
It's only at 10 to minus 1 here, so you wouldn't be able to see that in the Fermi data so far.
Well, those error bars are tiny. I think I disagree.
Yeah. No, you still have these systematics on top. I mean, the statistical error bars are very small, but you still got like systematics of 10% on top.
Yeah. I mean, I agree with that, but those systematics are correlated. So the fact that it's smooth strongly prohibits a 10% feature.
It's not a 10% feature, right? It's just a small feature on top of 10%. So this is just a fraction of 10%, right?
Yeah.
But I mean, in any case, I'm not claiming that there's actually substructure, right? You remember what I said before? Everything is in agreement with or consistent with a smooth curve. It's really just if you saw something, and maybe you would see something correlated in the total electron positron flux, which is also going to be measured by AMS2, then you could think about astrophysical sources being a good explanation of that.
Are you going to talk about the injection spectrum, which I guess is this gamma?
Absolutely. So I'm going to make a brief comment on the injection spectrum pulsar models and how it's not really well constrained. And basically, in another model that I'm going to propose later, we're trying to fix the injection spectrum by other means, by gamma ray observations.
So when you say there's no substructure, right, this also depends on the propagation model, right? Like you assume some uniform propagation model, then things are not as affected as, you know, if there's some clump of baryons which is causing some energy loss for some nearby source versus...
Well, the clump of baryons shouldn't really produce that much energy losses. What you could think about is that your Thomson approximation isn't correct and that you actually need to go to the Klein-Nishino regime. There you can get a suppression of the energy loss rate once basically... you go for this particular radiation background, you go to the Klein-Nishino regime, that can basically also produce bumps in the positron fraction. But it turns out it's not enough to explain the rise in the positron fraction, but just substructure on top of that. Pardon me?
What is the Klein-Nishino
region? Basically, it's the relativistic generalization of Compton scattering.
Okay.
So you might have a population of very hot stars somewhere, so that the photons in their radiation field are...
Basically, you really need to screw up what we know about the interstellar radiation fields and about the, exactly as you say, about the hot stars to get to rise in the positron fraction getting features in the total electron-positron flux on top of that is somewhat simpler. But in any case, that's also I'm going to show later, even if you take into account that we have discrete stochastic sources of cosmic ray electrons, you would expect to see some fluctuations and some bumps and wiggles, exactly something like this at higher energies. That could also give you some substructure.
I just want to have directional information from AMS.
That's something I'm going to talk about in a couple of slides. There is directional information, but it's not quite at the level yet to really constrain single source models, although that is quite flexible and depends on a couple of parameters. But just wait a couple of minutes, and I'm getting there. Let me come to my third part or the third misconception. It's either dark matter or pulses. I think that's wrong in two senses. First one, it's not dark matter, or at least let me put it that way. Dark matter models and annihilation models are very much constrained. All kinds of observation. People have put a lot of effort working out these constraints. After the rise in the positron fraction was seen by Pamela, you got constraints from hadronic cosmic rays, from cosmology, also from gamma rays, including not only typical sources where you look for dark matter, dwarf spheroidals, or the extragalactic gamma ray background, but even the Milky Way halo itself. And the idea is, of course, to look at the annihilation of dark matter producing gamma rays, either prompt gamma rays or finite state radiation, or in this Compton scattering of positrons that get produced. And that, of course, gives you a handle on checking the explanation, the dark matter explanation of the rise in the positron fraction. So what we're looking at is a result of an n-body simulation, basically dark matter density square, integrated along a line of sight. You see all the substructure, but here I'm going to focus on the smooth halo. And you can see the dark, the galactic center is really the brightest source of gamma rays. And the challenge is, of course, to find these gamma rays or constrain this gamma ray production amongst the background from astrophysics, because what Fermilab sees is something that doesn't look like that at all. Here is the gamma ray sky above 100 MeV after 3 years. What you can see, first of all, very much dominated by the bright emission from the galactic plane. These point sources are most likely not dark matter subhalos, but mostly blazars, a couple of pulsars, also nebula, supernova remnants, so rather astrophysical sources. And you can also see some larger substructure, which I'm going to talk about in the second part of my talk, Fermi bubbles coming out here. And also there's something, a North Polar spur, possibly a very old supernova remnant, relatively nearby, also shining up in gamma rays. So in the plane, you're basically totally lost when you want to set dark matter constraints. So the idea is to look slightly off the plane in these two regions of interest above and below the galactic plane, because there you still have some contribution from your dark matter halo, but you're not quite as constrained, quite as much overwhelmed by your galactic foregrounds. But still, there's a problem. If you look at the sky map from dark matter annihilation to BB bar or mu plus mu minus, you can see this nice almost spherically morphology, but you could also get something from astrophysical backgrounds. For example, if you have a source population that peaks at the galactic center, the inverse Compton scatter on the very intense radiation backgrounds at the galactic center and give morphologies which are very similar. So it's really difficult to work out the differences. Morphology is not simply that good to handle. And in that respect, there's no smoking gun signature if you look for extended emission from the galactic center, from the galactic halo. And all the excesses that we see, if we see some at all, could be due to deficiency in our astrophysical model. So what most people have decided to do is just set conservative constraints on the dark matter model, on the annihilation cross-section, on the lifetime. You can do that in two ways. Either you can be ultra-conservative and assume there's no dark matter contribution to the gamma rays. Basically, you're requiring that your dark matter model is really saturating everything within bounds. That gives you a constraint. Or you can try to do better, try to do some modeling of the astrophysical backgrounds at the same time. But of course, you have this huge parameter space of cosmic ray propagation parameters, which a priori we cannot constrain by external information, by other measurements. So we like to fit that at the same time, because gamma rays, for example, give good constraints on the source distribution. The spectral index is also something which you're very sensitive to. Height of the diffusive halo, of course, has a very strong effect on the gamma ray signal, both from astrophysics but also from dark matter annihilation, at least on the inverse Compton part. And then you have some conversion factors between observed gas densities and the real gas densities which the gamma rays are produced on.
So I know that's a question of semantics, but why do you call it too conservative? Why do you call it a conservative approach?
Because you're not assuming a certain model and subtracting that from the data and then claiming that everything which you can't explain is dark matter. but you're trying to find the model that gives the best fit to the dark matter. That's something which you could do. I just guessed these parameters, put them in my propagation model.
That's wrong, right? That's plain wrong. Yeah. Can't do that.
Well, if you have a very constrained propagation model in this model context, it's correct.
You just said you can't have
that. No, in principle you can do that. Or you can be more bold. You can try, for example, to guess the backgrounds in the galactic center from what you see along the galactic plane, subtract that off by just assuming that basically what you see along a line through the galactic center, in front of and behind of the galactic center, is basically the same as you see in the disk. You subtract that off, and then you see we have an excess. Might be dark matter, might be something else. That's something that Dan has worked on, that other people have worked on. I wouldn't say that's wrong. It's just not as conservative as just setting bounds.
In the sense that, it's based on your assumptions. If your assumptions are off, you rely on that. I don't think that is conservative.
It's much more general assumptions. In that way, I would say it's conservative. And depending...
It is better than 90% of the papers that are written. I mean, it's more realistic.
Yeah. Okay.
My guess is if you take the version 2 here, you get constraints that are within, or option 2, you get constraints that are within a few tens of percents, 50% or something of those you get from the last option there. So, I mean, if we keep that in mind,
actually, of course, the Fermilab collaboration has looked at the variation that you still have on these limits if you vary your parameters. I mean, if you vary from the best fit model, or the model giving you the best constraint, and vary that into something else, you only get uncertainties of 10%. So I would say these limits are really quite robust and quite trustworthy. Of course, they're probably not as good as you could do if you were bolder and were assuming something else. And
there's no indirect detection constraint anywhere that anyone should believe is more accurate than 10%.
Well, it turns out what's mostly holding you back is really the source distribution, because that essentially, to be conservative, they've assumed that the source distribution at the galactic center goes to zero. Exactly, that is the point about the electrons that I just tried to make, not to have any sources that could really mimic dark matter signal, but let the dark matter really saturate all the gamma rays that are coming from the galactic center region. So let me skip to the results of this analysis. Here's your bounds on annihilating dark matter that basically come in three flavors for different annihilation channels and also different dark matter profiles, NFW, isothermal, mu plus, mu minus, tau plus, pi minus. And the contours are showing the region that would allow to explain a rise in the positron fraction, or the smaller blue contour even to explain a feature seen in the total electron positron flux if you choose a rather conservative and soft astrophysical background. But now let's talk about the bounds. The blue one is what I called before ultra-conservative, not making any assumptions about the astrophysics, but if you fit your astrophysical model at the same time, you get these two lines depending on whether you just take final state radiation into account, or also the inverse Compton scattering of the electrons which are produced by decay of mu plus, mu minus,
and tau. I have a comment about the conservative definition of its limits, because what the collaboration did to extract, basically determine the background in this region that you highlighted in the previous slides, was to actually get a background model by tuning it in those regions. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how you can possibly call it conservative, because you're using this region where you're trying to determine whether there is an excess or not, and tuning your background model in that region. So you could be making, what you could be doing is to absorb some of your signal into the background, and as a result, your limits are not going to be conservative.
Oh, well,
you
can do that. Basically, your model is simply defined by a set of parameters. You can vary your bound as a function of these parameters and work out by how much they change. And that's exactly the number I just quoted, 10% at most.
What they did is to actually tune the background model in those regions.
If you choose parameters that are set, for example, that are hinted at by other observations, if you choose the diffusion coefficient in the range which we know, for example, from nuclear secondary primaries locally observed, you can test how how much you're really just fitting a background to the signal region, and by how much it's actually depending on the stark matter fit.
Right, but also in this particular analysis, the tuning, as I said, was done in those specific region. It wasn't even checked that those best fit parameters that you get actually gave you a good description of the sky in other.
In a certain sense, you wouldn't even expect that. For example, if you're looking at the diffusion coefficient they get out of that.
Say that that's an acceptable set.
Because it's the diffusion coefficient that's relevant for this particular region, for this band in the sky. No, it's an effective parameter. In a similar way that the diffusion coefficient, which we work out from nuclear secondary prime ratios, you could argue isn't a physical meaningful parameter because it's a global average over all the sources which contribute to the boron and carbon fluxes.
Yeah, but then you have the problem that Simon was pointing out, because you observe some of the same epistemological
parameters. But aren't you saying that you're varying alpha these?
That's why you do the check and vary these parameters within physical region that are claimed by other observations. And you don't find a huge dependency on the limits on these numbers, at most 10%. And the only parameter or the only input that really changes the limits a lot would be the source distribution.
You can do that, but you cannot call it conservative.
So, if you had taken what you'd call a conservative approach, Simona, how much do you think the lines might change?
Well, I think that that's the blue line, right?
What the collaboration calls conservative,
because you're basically taking all the data that you see, and you're just assuming that the dark matter doesn't exceed your observation, and that's the conservative, and that's the highest line that he has on those points.
So it sounds a bit like we're again talking about semantics.
Conservative has a specific meaning.
I mean, there is a point where you go from being reasonably conservative to ultra conservative, right? And that's what we're debating, right? There are degrees of conservatism, right? I mean, there's Strom Thurmond, and then there's John McCain, and they're different things, you know?
But basically, Simona, to get to these bounds, you would totally compress your cosmic ray density distribution everywhere in the galaxy. Okay, let me move on then. For decaying dark matter, the bounds are not quite as good, not as competitive, for example, as bounds from the extragalactic isotropic background. But even on a tau channel, you can see that the bounds are cutting into the region where you could explain Fermi, not the total electron-positron flux or the positron fraction. And some other way, which I found quite convincing, that actually you're not really missing out on any dark matter signal. You can look at the residuals. Basically, the counts you have in a particular angular bin, your model counts, subtract these two from each other, and you can see that the residuals basically get are quite similar, or the regions where you have excesses or deficits are pretty much the same, whether you include dark matter, sorry, this is this side in your fit, or whether you assume there's no dark matter, you're not fitting for dark matter at all. You have some regions where you see excesses and deficits, and actually we believe that we understand some of these features. For example, this bright feature here might be a part of loop one, this huge supernova remnant, which I already talked about. You have an excess here, right next to if you have deficit, that looks like you're over-subtracting, or you're overcompensating for something that actually contributes here, and that might be the southern Fermi bubble, something I'm going to cover in the second part of my talk.
So can you just go back to the slides and continue to
learn a few
things?
What exactly?
These are galactic center bounds, right?
No, it's from the halo, this band above the galactic plane, okay. 5 and 15 degree in latitude.
And where are the dwarf galaxy bounds?
On this plot?
Yeah.
They're more constraining, so they basically hit the thermal annihilation cross section somewhere around here.
Right.
But I mean this is really the most direct constraint, because here you're sensitive to the Inverse quantum scattering of these electrons. For example, if you really want to explain the rise in the positron fraction, you need to produce these particles somewhere in this target region as well, right? Because that's where you have dark matter density. But the gamma ray constraint tells you then you would see Inverse quantum scattering of these electrons and positrons, which we don't see, or at least not at this level. So that's how you put constraint on your on your Laytian cross section.
Okay, and the second thing is, I thought you needed an relation to Calus to predict the soft rise in the spectrum. So isn't mu plus mu minus or something like that already disfavored? If you want to explain the positron, right?
That very much depends on your background, what you choose for the astrophysical electron background. If you vary that, you can still get reasonable agreement with mu plus mu minus.
How much of it is coming from, say, mu plus mu minus at these masses, right? How much of the positron fraction is coming from, positron excess is coming from?
Basically everything. So the secondary bipropagation of primary cosmic ray nuclei is going down to 10 to minus 3 or so at these energies. So basically all of the positrons in these models are coming from dark matter annihilation. So that's basically a dark matter only model. So we're not talking about rise from astrophysical sources and then some dark matter on top. It's all dark matter here.
Those blobs include AMS too?
No, actually that's some comment I should have made before, thank you, and Gianfranco, because that's before AMS2. And of course, there's still a data range, a dark matter mass range allowed between hundreds of GeV and maybe 350 or 400 GeV, which is now ruled out because we've seen the rise in the positron fraction beyond these energies, or at least up to
350 GeV. I don't understand.
No, I was just about to say that if I remember correctly, you pointed out that for these channels, you don't get a good fit to AMS2.
You can get something better fit if you choose something softer, annihilation wise, some mediators or something.
But combine the Fermi spectrum, electron spectrum with AMS2, you can always do something else in the astrophysics, but we consider a pretty wide range of scenarios, and we couldn't get mu plus mu minus to fit, although it wasn't that far off, so I could imagine.
But that is if you have a simple power law extrapolation of the electron spectrum from lower energies.
A broken power law.
No, but basically if you have fluctuations from nearby electron sources only, you basically can fit everything with that, right? Even with mu plus mu minus. In essentially, the mu plus mu minus spectrum and the electron spectrum that you observe after propagation looks very similar to every pulsar spectrum that you can make up, right? And you can fit pulses with a fluctuating electron spectrum from the source stochasticity to the total electron positron flux and the positron fraction. So I think it's really just the simple power law extrapolations of the electron spectrum from lower energies that give you a hard time in fitting, for example, mu plus mu minus.
And what are the regions you showed? There's a Pinella region and then what's a smaller one?
That's the total electron positron flux. So that's already assuming a certain power law for the electron spectrum. And then you need a bump that cuts off around a TeV or so to fit the total electron positron flux, in particular the Hess data.
Okay. What do you say Hess in the Fermi
data? Because Fermi data are only going up about to a TeV or a few hundred GeV. Yeah. Beyond that, you have data from Cherenkov telescope arrays, which look for the electron component in the showers.
Sure.
That is giving you a much better constraint. Sorry, we're now talking about electron-positron flux data for Fermi. That's included in the dark matter fits.
Yeah,
for example, in this one, that's included, yeah.
So that was determining the blob there.
Exactly, yeah. So if you didn't see a cutoff or turnover in the electron-positron flux at these energies, this blob would, of course, extend to higher energies. Now, in the interest of time, let's skip some of the criticism of pulsar models, and I'm just going to cover something about anisotropies. Actually, what I wanted to say before is that the model parameters of the pulsar models are somewhat not well defined because.
About these the spectrum of electrons plus positrons observed by this Cherenkov telescope array. Is there did Veritas say something about it?
MAGIC did. Veritas, I don't think so.
Okay. In MAGIC found
but it's found still not at the same with the same statistics as Hess.
Okay.
But MAGIC basically also saw turnover. Basically, they put some constraint on very high energy bins, but the electron positron, basically the leptonic component, is smaller, so that there must be a break or it's at least an exponential cutoff at some point. Basically, the point I wanted to make is that when people try to fit the electron positron fraction or explain the total electron positron fraction with pulses, they always quote a range of spectral indices, of cutoff energies, which aren't really calculable a priori from these models, but which are fit to observation of pulses. But what you actually have and what the electrons, positrons come from, it's not the pulses sitting naked there in the interstellar medium, but it's actually in a pulse event nebula by these jets coming from the pulsar. They create a shock at the point where the wind stalls due to the Rump pressure of the matter around that, of the ambient matter. The whole thing is even sitting in a supernova remnant, which has been produced in the same supernova event as the pulsar. Basically, all these processes going on in the pulse event nebula and the supernova remnant can affect your energetics of the pulsar, can affect the spectral index by cooling or acceleration processes, and of course also the cutoff energy. So basically what you should do is look at pulse event nebulas, determine their parameters, set up a statistical model for these pulse event nebula, and just hope that the particles either escaping from these sources or which are just set free once the pulse event nebula and the shocks die down, the same parameters as you observe in these sources. So I really think that the parameters are not that clear cut, and therefore these models are not very predictive. It's a Laplacian model. You don't get any neutrinos. You can get gamma rays, and that might tell you something about the electrons in the pulse event nebula, but apart from that, it's not very predictive. Now, you might ask, are there any other clear-cut messengers or any other signals that might show you there's a pulsar behind the rise in the positron fraction? What some people have claimed is anisotropies. Basically, in the simplest diffusive model, everything is isotropic. The particle distribution is isotropic. But of course,
ask you something. Previous slide.
Sure.
Why or how do you not get neutrinos if you have shock?
Oh, it's not coming from the pulses. Of course, if you have shocks and once the jet or the wind becomes kinetic, you're of course creating shocks and can accelerate hadrons. And create neutrinos and also hadronic gamma rays. But that, in principle, has nothing to do with the pulsar. That's really just the shock front. Yeah, and in principle, that's very similar to the shock front and the shock acceleration you have in the supernova.
And the estimates you get are really small for the hadronic.
Yeah, absolutely. So as I was saying, the anisotropies, you can calculate as, so to say, a first correction to the isotropic particle distribution. Turns out it's proportional to the gradient of the flux at any one point. As you can see, you have the diffusion coefficient here in this equation, and that's coming back to the point I was making before. You don't expect the diffusion coefficient to be the same everywhere in the galaxy. And the one we work out from nuclear secondary prime ratios like boron over carbon is really an average of a diffusion coefficient within kiloparsec distances from the solar system. But the diffusion coefficient you have here is the local one, and there's no reason these should necessarily be the same. So you have an uncertainty on this, which is basically shifting up your anisotropy predictions. And the second point I want to make, we have actually seen anisotropies, not in electrons, positrons, but in hadronic cosmic rays. And that's something that IceCube has published results on, Milagro, RBYBJ, lots of experiments have seen these anisotropies very consistently. What I'm showing here is just the significance map for anisotropies below a certain angular scale, below 30 degrees, I believe. And the amplitude is 10 to minus 4. You also have a dipole or larger angular component with an amplitude of 10 to minus 3 or so.
I must admit, I've never seen a negative significance before.
That's because you subtract off the dipole component, the large scale component.
Well, it's a sigma,
it must be the
amplitude or something.
What is
the large scale
component?
Sure,
that's what it is. It's a 2 sigma downward.
That's basically a deficit, and that's an excess.
That's the fluctuation of this below the dipole, right?
Absolutely, because the dipole and the large-scale component, especially the monopole, has been subtracted off. So you see deficits here, excesses here. And what's remarkable is that the regions where you see deficit and excesses is really quite small,
down to
degrees of 10 degrees or so, down to scales of 10 degrees or so. That's, of course, something which you cannot understand in the simple diffusive model, where you only expect a dipole. In particular, hadronic cosmic rays don't have energy losses, so you're not even sensitive only to the nearby sources. But again, you're basically sensitive to all the sources. That's why the dipole you would see is already quite small, but these smaller scale anisotropies are quite puzzling. The only reason you can imagine that something like this is happening is when you modify the local magnetic field. So you have something going on, anisotropic diffusion, or maybe we're just looking at the magnetic field realization that we're living in the nearby universe around the solar system. And that's why you get these very narrow regions where cosmic rays have slight excesses or deficits. But that, of course, also means if we have this weird features at smaller scales and the local magnetic field is somehow modified compared to the simple diffusive isotropic setup, how can we be certain that we really see excesses from sources, not just a similar effect from a totally isotropic electron positron distribution in the first place?
What energies is this magnet?
That's around tens of TeV up to 100 TeV. Actually, I think at PV, this anisotropy is basically cut off. But that's probably mostly due to the galactic cosmic ray flux also being suppressed at these energies.
It's not crazy at all that the magnetic field would be like this, right? Live on the side of a bubble and there's some weird morphology.
Absolutely not. And it's actually quite remarkable that the simple diffusive model has been working so far. And actually, there have, of course, been some difficulties even in this diffusive model. You would expect a dipole from exactly the argument that I said before, also for hadronic cosmic rays. And there have been some bounds that were really constraining our model. So basically, the observed anisotropy is already quite small compared to what you expect from your simple diffusive model.
So if you design a model for like the magnetic field that would produce these features, presumably you can set constraints will infer what kind of anisotropy we expect, since you observed this in the 10 to 100 mm-hmm. TeV region, mm-hmm. what kind of constraints, what kind of anisotropy you would expect in the sub-TeV?
That's exactly the argument some people have made. So even if we see anisotropies in hadrons, and that tells us something about the local magnetic field, can we use that to basically constrain the magnetic field in our local neighborhood and therefore really see the excesses in positrons? But of course, that only works for positrons. You don't have such a large flux in negative particles. And if you assume, well, if you,
that's what you expect,
that you have large-scale gradients in your magnetic field, you get drift effects, which are simply charge sign dependent. So you might get completely different anisotropies for electrons than for positrons. So you can, If you can work out the anisotropy for electrons alone, that would be, of course, great. But what you observe is always either the total electron-positron flux or the anisotropy of the positron fraction.
Who did that?
Who did?
The study of what happens, extrapolating from a 10 to TeV region to sub-TeV region. You said someone had an argument about that?
Oh, that was Profumann. They just made, not a qualitative argument, not a quantitative argument, just saying, if we see anisotropies in hadrons, we know that tells us something about the local magnetic field. You can subtract that off and still set bounds on that. But that was just a qualitative point. So let me come to a model which I think is equally good as pulses in the sense that production of positrons is also guaranteed. And it's even better in the sense that you can set constraints on other observables from these models, so in a way it's way more predictive. The idea is that you can not only produce positrons and electrons as secondary particles during the propagation through the galaxy, but also in the sources themselves. And the reason why this has been neglected until recently was the argument was particles, primary particles, spend only a limited amount of time in the sources compared to the time they spend in the galaxies, 10 megayears or so. So the source density, even if it's increased, won't give you that much more grammage. And the total number of positrons of all secondaries produced in the sources is relatively small compared to the positrons, to the total number of secondary particles produced in the galaxy. But of course, what this argument neglects is that the particles produced in the sources are produced somewhere nearby the shock front, can participate in the acceleration process, can have a different spectrum than the particles produced in the galaxy. And that means that even if the total number is relatively small, it can stick out at higher energies and lead to an observable effect.
I didn't understand the criticism that you made for pulses. I didn't see it. What?
Basically, the parameters that people put into the pulses, pulsar model are coming from the pulse itself, not from the pulsar wind nebula. Secondly, you don't produce leptons from the you don't produce neutrinos or gamma rays from the neutrinos from the pulse itself. Don't produce any hadronic cosmic rays. That's all something that's produced in this model that you can use to constrain that.
I mean, it's totally viable for AMS and for
There's no argument like that they violate energetics or something like that.
And the anisotropies don't really apply necessarily because you would have a diffuse flux of supernovae.
But the problem is then your model is not very good,
which doesn't rule it
out. It's just maybe not the first on your list you can check, or you would like to check.
Okay, but I mean, I think there are two camps, right? That you could have single specific holders contributing to the AMS and panel excesses, or they could be distributed.
Absolutely, that's also a possibility. And then you don't even have, in the most optimistic anisotropy model, you don't even have that exactly. So this idea of the Sanglis being produced in the supernova remnants goes back to Pasquale Blasi. What we did, we extended on this model several ways, exactly what I just tried to outline, making this connection with other messengers, neutrinos, cosmic ray nuclei. And as I said before, the production of the positrons is guaranteed in the sense that we have all the ingredients you need to produce charged pions because we see hadronic gamma rays from these sources. So we have ING. Cosmic ray protons, nuclei, we have a gas density, so you'd also expect the production of positrons. Now the question is just how much they participate in the acceleration process and how much the spectrum changes. But that's something which we try to really constrain with the gamma ray observations, so basically the production of these positrons, and then there's only one free parameter that tells you the normalization of the diffusion coefficient, basically the overall normalization, the overall contribution of these accelerated particles to the flux. Let me quickly go through diffusion shock acceleration, which is the paradigm acceleration process in basically every environment where you have shocks, in particular supernova remnants. So the idea is you have a supernova event. Matter is ejected at supersonic velocities. You have a shock front that's plowing the interstellar medium, and you have matter flowing into the shock from the upstream side, flowing out into the bulk of the supernova remnant on the downstream side. And the one parameter characterizing a shock is the compression ratio, just the ratio of velocities or of densities, and that turns out later to be setting the spectral index of your high energy particle spectrum. The way you work the spectrum out is you solve the transport equation with appropriate boundary conditions, and your solution turns out to be factorizing two parts, a momentum part down here and a spatial part. I just want to point something out about the spatial part. Inside the supernova remnant for fixed energy, the profile of these particles is constant, but then it decreases exponentially, which somehow encodes the information the particles only in this diffusion zone can participate in the acceleration process. If they get too far away from the shock front, they cannot travel back through the shock front anymore. They are lost from propagation. And the momentum part basically tells you that depending on the compression ratio, which we know for high Mach number shocks is always 4, you get a spectral index in your distribution function of 4, or a spectral index of -2 in your energy spectrum. Now what changes if we add secondaries to this problem? They basically get produced in the same spectrum as the primary particles, so also e^-2 in the energy spectrum. But now, as I said before, only particles within a certain distance from the shock front can participate in the acceleration process. This distance depends on the momentum dependence of the diffusion coefficient and the velocity. So you can see that at low energies, this diffusion zone is rather small. Only a small number of particles can really go into acceleration, whereas at higher energies, a larger number of particles can participate in the acceleration process. So basically, the fraction of these particles that get boosted in energy are later sticking out on the spectrum goes like momentum. And now you add up the two contributions. Those positrons, which get produced somewhere in the supernova remnant, don't participate in the acceleration process. They have a flat spectrum, exactly the same spectrum as primaries, but then the fraction that goes like momentum sticks out at higher energies, and that's what leads to a rise in the positron fraction. Of course, this is only, so far, this is only the positron fraction at source. You have to propagate them. So again, you solve a transport equation. Now in the galaxy with a diffusion term, energy losses, and injection term, your boundary conditions is basically that the number of the particles on number density goes to 0. On the surface of your propagation volume, which is usually assumed to be a cylinder with a galactic disk sitting in the middle. And now the Green's function of this diffusion equation gives you a contribution from one point like burst-like source, which is emitting all the particles into the interstellar medium at once. And let me skip over a slightly technical point and tell you how we modeled the distribution of sources. Unfortunately, it's not possible to make a direct connection with the observed supernova remnants because the supernova remnants we see in gamma rays haven't died down. The particles are not necessarily released. Plus, there's, of course, a time lag from the diffusion of charged particles compared to the gamma rays. So those that we see in gamma rays are not necessarily those supernova remnants contributing to the particle flux that we have today. So we set up a statistical model, both in time. Basically, the supernova rate hasn't changed much over the last 10 mega years or so. So we set that constant. And then we just need a distribution in position. So we use the information we have on the spiral density of stars in the galaxy. We also modulate that with the radial distribution. That basically gives you the probability density to find a source at a particular distance from Earth, shown by this blue line here. Everything was homogeneous in two dimension. Of course, you would only expect this straight line here. Now, the idea is to populate our galaxy with a large number of supernova remnants, add up the Green's function from all these sources to calculate the total electron-positron flux. And of course, that very much depends, in particular at high energies, on the particular realization you have of the source in the galaxy. And then we said we let the data basically pick the model of the source distribution which is closest to the real one, simply by saying all these source distributions which have too many nearby sources would give you an excess in the total electron-positron flux. So that's why on this plot for the primary electrons alone, I'm showing a large number of gray lines, each corresponding to a certain distribution of the sources in our galaxy. And you can already see some of these source distributions would give you an excess beyond the Hess data, beyond these blue data points here. So they are basically ruled out. But what you should note first is that there definitely is a deficit, at least with the spectral index that we worked out from the gamma ray observation of the supernova remnants, which you also expect to hold for electrons. The spectrum is so soft and cannot really explain the total electron-positron flux as seen by Fermi and by Hess. So what you need is really already here an additional contribution. This is now where the secondary electrons and positrons come in. They have a very hard spectrum, basically the same energy cutoff as the primary electrons. They can nicely bring that back into agreement. So if we add that up, you can see that there's a huge number of models which can nicely fit the total electron-positron flux. But as I said before, we want to work out the source distribution. So that's why we kept only those models, those three models, which gave the best chi-square fit to the data here.
So, Fermi had pointed out that they could just change the background injection spectrum and fit all the data.
But then you're not in agreement with gamma observation of supernova remnants. Basically, what we did is we worked out the injection spectral index by observing gamma ray data from Cherenkov telescopes. By looking at gamma ray data from Cherenkov telescopes, from the gamma ray data, you can work out the spectral index of protons, which should be the same as for electrons. That's basically constraining your spectral index at injection.
What about the argument you made that these might not be the right population of guys to be looking at because you have to wait for their gamma rays to get to you and things like that?
Exactly, but at the energies where we're looking at, that is between tens of GeV up going to a TeV or so, there's no chance that these particles escape from the sources already, but they only get set free once the supernova remnant dies down.
Wait, did this come back again? So if Fermi changes the spectral index, they disagree with gamma ray data low energy,
right? Actually, the gamma ray data is rather TeV energy.
No, I know the test data. Yeah, I'm talking about that. I'm very eager. I thought you were referring to people. So you're saying that when they change their spectral index for the supernova remnants, they agree with the Eblasian spectrum or disagree with Hess and high energies?
They don't disagree with the Hess electron-positron flux data, but with the Hess gamma ray observations. Because we don't see E to minus 2 gamma rays, or we don't see E to minus 2 protons leading to gamma rays in supernova remnants. We see a much softer spectrum, which is rather E to minus 2.4, something like that.
Do you have reference?
Absolutely. I got plenty of reference. So that is basically the sources we looked at. Supernova remnants, which have been seen by Hess, which are most likely hadronic. And they always show spectral indices of the protons, which lead to the gamma ray spectrum, which are softer than 2 in most cases. Well, maybe not this one. And the average spectral index you can work out depending on whether you make a cutoff in the spectral index is somewhere around 2.4.
Oh, I see. So you look at specific
sources. But you have to assume some delta to back at the injection spectrum.
The
diffusion.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
That is basically constrained by nuclear secondary to prime ratios, boron to carbon. Well,
so where are these guys? I mean, in
distances between 200 parsecs and really 10 kiloparsecs or so.
So you could imagine in some sort of very spatially dependent diffusion coefficient, but I mean, I don't know to what extent.
Well, of course, that's what you ultimately like to do. You have reason to believe that the diffusion coefficient near supernova remnants is much suppressed because there's lots of turbulence and so on. But unfortunately, we don't have any handle on that unless you give me another observable that we can use to really pin down the diffusion coefficient locally. That's not possible.
But earlier you were willing to change the propagation model from one part of the sky to the other. I mean, that was when you were putting bounds on the imaginary.
Yeah. But you don't have an additional observable to give you this
angle.
I mean, if you do a fit to the gamma ray sky, that might be something which you could try to do. Look at different regions in the sky. If you're looking at high latitude, most of your mission comes from very nearby regions. And that's something that Fermilab Corporation has done already. But then, of course, you have degeneracy with the source distribution, of course.
You have to imagine that our local region is very different than typical in the galaxy, and there's just no reason to.
How much different? I guess that's good. I mean, it sounds like for me, E plus E minus.
That was just because their whole propagation model from Moscow and Grand Strong was pretty good there.
But just from the positron fraction alone, you know there's an extra contribution, right? It should also contribute to the electron positron fraction up to 10%, right? Yeah.
But the excess that you were showing in the previous slide is much bigger than 10%.
No, it isn't. Yeah. No, just look at the numbers and look at this here.
No, I just...
Oh, well, a way to tell is, of course, to look at the positron fraction, right?
Yeah.
So you can see... Down here, where we have data, we're still at 10%, a bit above 10%, 15% or so.
No, I didn't mean your model. I'm just thinking of, basically trying to say that it didn't seem necessary to invoke any new contribution to explain the Fermi data. The Fermi E plus E minus spectrum.
And unless you're happy to live with different spectral indices for the electrons than for protons that we know from gamma ray observations. Then you can do that. I mean, yeah.
I'm fine with putting a new population in, but I think it's a pretty strong statement to say that you can't mess with these spectral indices at all.
The connection, you have to mess with them a lot, is the thing.
Yeah, but there's some uncertainty in them. I'm not saying you
mean,
can make up this
you mean
entire
in,
thing,
in propagation?
Yeah.
Oh, that's for sure, yeah.
Yeah, I just, it's not like we know these things to order
them. Oh, no. But that's hopefully something that AMS2 will also help us constrain, right? Through the bone to carbon ratio, give us better constraints on that.
So let me ask you about something else. So in the scenario where you have the secondary production producing positrons, you also expect similar features to appear in born carbon?
Absolutely. Thank you very much. That's what I had actually on my next slide. And
isn't this about low energies?
Just let me go to the next slide, and I try to shade that because solar modulation is exactly expected to contribute at these energies. And actually, it's a bit embarrassing that we haven't made enough progress in solar modulation models. So what people and what we did in our earlier paper on this actually do is to bracket this, having two both very unrealistic but extreme solar modulation models. On the one hand, so the simplest approximation is just that the particles, charged particles, run up against the solar wind. So you have just this fairly symmetric potential, which is suppressing the particle fluxes. That already turns out not to give a good fit to the positron fraction, also not to bring measurements between different epochs of the solar cycle into agreement. So basically what you need to invoke is some charge sign dependency. But in principle, then you just have two different potentials for electrons, positrons, or positive and negative particles. Doesn't necessarily make sense. So what people have started doing now is really model the propagation in the heliosphere to very high detail with all the charge sign dependent drift effects and so on. And they have basically made predictions for the positron fraction just by modulating that from one particular epoch where you have a measurement to the epoch where AMS2 made its measurement, so basically last year or last 2 years, and they failed. So still at low energy, we don't have a very good model for solar modulation. That's simply something that constrains us to go not below 10 GeV or so.
So right now, I just want to maximum diversity spread in the lower, at the higher energies, it seems smaller than the for the E plus and plus minus. Just because you
the spread between the different models.
That's absolutely.
You mean between these different lines here?
Right.
Absolutely correct. That has to do with our feature because the electrons and positrons coming from the same sources. So basically, the no matter whether we have. Let me go back to the total electron-positron flux. No matter whether we have a source that's contributing to this level here or whether it's here, the ratio of electrons and positrons coming from the same source, and that's why there's not such strong fluctuation in the positron fraction.
And yes, I thought that one of the aims of FAMLA was precisely to be able to make a model reliable data for a full model.
Oh yeah, they have provided the data, and that's what people started from. Basically, as I said, demodulating that for a different epoch in the solar cycle, but that's not what AMS2 sees. Basically, the model is lacking. They're not in agreement within the simplest model, but also not in the more complicated model that people have done after the AMS after the PAMLA data came out. Well, I wouldn't say the data are in contradiction. We just don't understand solar modulation well enough to bring them into agreement. So basically,
this is the hardest sort of stuff for physicists to do. I mean, it's exactly where all of the like clean assumptions we like to make about things are completely wrong.
Yeah.
But I mean, PAMLA is still taking data at this stage.
It is still taking.
So they took data simultaneously. So
they
the
also. Oh, in principle, it should be compatible. But then you have huge statistical uncertainties because PAMLA is much smaller than AMS2. But in principle, you could compare these two. But PAMLA hasn't really published the data for just the period where AMS2 has taken data. And something else I should say about the solar modulation. You might think, now we're talking about everything above 10 GeV, so what do we care about solar modulation? But of course, there are indirect channels like antideuterons where you're very sensitive to these kinds of energies and where you want a better model for solar modulation simply to get better constraints in black matter models.
So now maybe I'll ask for the positron fraction, the next slide.
Sure.
So now if, let's say, you get data which would turn over more quickly than your prediction, could you still tweak your prediction with the diffusion such that you would
I wouldn't try to tweak the diffusion. It's rather that you would change the source model that you would expect somehow in the older supernova remnants that contribute most to these positron fluxes. You would expect to have a lower cutoff in energy simply because these particles have been sitting around for 10 to 4 years, and you wouldn't expect them to extend up to 10 TeV. We have a cutoff at 20 TeV, which is still viable. But actually, if you have the cutoff lower energies, that would also go down.
Also, like around 10 TeV, there should be like the energy losses for these electrons should be stochastic, and basically you shouldn't know what's going on there. So there should be a big error bar.
There should definitely be, just from the energy losses and exactly this transition between the Thomson regime and the Klein-Shima regime alone, right? But
also the distribution.
That's something that's a point that I tried to make before. That's exactly what you already see here.
Yeah.
So maybe my binning of the points isn't fine enough, but you can basically already see bumps and wiggles here, which come from exactly that the energy loss length is becoming smaller than the source distance. Basically, you only see a few nearby sources. You see the individual bumps from the Green's function from the sources.
So I think it's an extra slide.
At some point, I should really address Dan's point.
Oh, but Seaborn,
pardon. Ken Seaborn to Carlin.
If you change that to the 20 TeV that operator,
yeah.
What if you chose 10 TeV? Does it improve? I mean, why have we chosen 10 TeV?
Oh, because we wanted just a simple model. And we looked at leptonic supernova remnants, where you basically see the gamma rays coming from leptons or from X-rays, and that's basically giving us a bound on the highest lepton energy. Then we just took these cutoff exactly for the secondary electrons and positrons. But of course, as I said, if you take to count the much higher age of these electrons, positrons, and these old supernova remnants, that can give you a different bound. And this levels out simply because the cutoff energy is the same. If the cutoff energy of the secondary positrons and electrons would be lower, this would be going down in some energy. coming to boron over carbon, I skipped titanium over iron, where basically ATTIC 2 had already seen some rise, of course, in disagreement with TiO3, so you might not take that too seriously. But here's boron over carbon. I think that's what Dan is alluding to. If you take this last cream data point seriously, the predictions depend on the normalization of the diffusion coefficient, which was 10 in our explanation of the positron fraction rise, looks somewhat in disagreement with cream. Of course, there's this systematic error bar, which doesn't really come out here in this plot. Of course, we had hope for Pamela. They had promised us the measurement of the boron to carbon ratio up to, I think, 250 GeV or so. We've been waiting for a couple of years now. And what they showed rather early in the data release just went up to a few tens of GeV. What they did afterwards is they stopped showing the boron to carbon ratio, but just showing separate carbon and boron fluxes. And actually, if you calculate the boron to carbon ratio itself, it seems to be going up. That's something that we were asked not to show because of all the systematics. That's, of course, only preliminary. But I think you can already see that the boron flux looks like a power law here.
3 years ago.
And the carbon flux.
Surely they must have sorted this out.
The last time they showed something was at ICRC 2 years ago. There they only went up to 100 GeV per nucleon. And what they say is basically that their tracker is saturated. So they can't really work out the rigidity of the particles, which they see beyond 100 GeV or so.
Can you go back to the previous slide or something?
I can go to the next slide, where I also show the result from TRACER experiment, Bloom-Born experiment, which also showed data from their 2006 flight. And they have one very interesting data point at 2 TeV, which is basically spot on for the normalization of 10. Of course, now you have one cream data point, which is lower, one tracer data point, which is higher, which doesn't tell you that awful much. But AMS2, as you said, is bigger and has much more better particle identification and charge identification because they basically have three or four different subsystems that allow them to distinguish between boron and carbon nuclei. We hope that they will definitely go beyond GeV. They will definitely go beyond 100 GeV. We hope they go somewhere in the 100 GeV range. But in the end, it might just be that we need long duration balloon flights to really go up to TeV energies to see what's going on with the boron to carbon ratio at these energies.
Is this just the equivalent of, say, sub-iron to iron? Or is
it... Exactly. Okay. Yeah. Well, the normalization changes a little bit.
So is there any reason, ATTIC, first of all, had all sorts of problems getting other things wrong.
And that's why I was only flashing this light, because people keep picking on
ATTIC. These error bars are huge. Mm-hmm. Whereas HEO, those error bars are small, and I don't know anything about it. Is there any reason I should be suspicious of those HEO error bars? Because if not, I would tend to say your idea is ruled out.
By titanium to iron?
By HEO's measurement.
Well, one thing they haven't really quantified is their systematics, which ATTIC has. And then again, basically, it's only the last data point, right? Which is really a disagreement.
Well, the second and third and fourth, the last ones all look pretty bad. So
okay, those are away. But I mean, these basically agree, right?
Those error bars are small. Now, they're many sigma off, but like you said, there are systematics that aren't quoted, so I...
Are you basically saying that the systematics should be similar to the ones of ATTIC?
Well, they might be all over the place, right? They haven't really quantified the systematics. So you see on the, well, it doesn't really come out on the projector here, but on the other, for example, the balloon borne experiment, they always show this error bar just with the systematics separately, which here with 3 didn't.
But I think it's even bump in almost every species.
That's what I just said. That's why I didn't show the slide for very long, so people don't start picking on ATTIC, because they have seen other stuff that's wrong. But I think boron to carbon is really something that much more interest is there, not just for the secondary to primary ratios.
This is something that AMS can do as well, and they'll nail this, right?
I'm not quite sure up to what energies they can go into titanium to iron. That's the problem. And they haven't quoted anything yet. They haven't promised. Whereas boron to carbon is interesting for narrowing down your diffusion model, and that's why there's much more interest, not just for the secondary
explanation of the rise in the positron fraction.
How high can they go in boron to carbon? You said
they go up to 500 GeV per nucleon. But they're always quite conservative. Just if you look at the statistic they should have had compared to Pamela. but it's mostly the different subsystems and basically that they have, that they can over-constrain the charge resolution compared to Palmer, for example. That's giving me the most hope that they could do better than that. Let me just come, I think I'm already out of time, but want to quickly talk about neutrinos, because now that we have this, let's move away from this slide. Now that we have this hadronic explanation for rise in the positron fraction, you might be more confident that we have a large number of hadronic accelerators in our galaxy. So of course, also observations from Fermi, which have seen the pion bump, some old supernova remnants. So maybe we're not that far from really narrowing down the source of galactic cosmic rays. And you might ask, if we have these large number of supernova remnants, which explains the rise in the positron fraction, what is our prediction for neutrinos? Basically, everything should be fixed now, spectral index. So we can calculate the flux above 3 TeV. It should be visible in ice cube. It's 7 times 10 to minus 13 centimeter per centimeter squared per second. Compare that to the last limit they set. I'm saying the last limit they set, which is still a factor of to larger. But now, as we already heard from...
Wait a second. Is that the right comparison, Nick? So their limit, I think, is something minus 2 spectrum that extends over that whole range. Yours doesn't.
No. No. But I mean, they haven't presented any limits that assume
right,
e to minus 4, have they?
That limit is overwhelmingly dominated by the highest energies. So they're not very
sensitive
to 3 TeV.
Most of the particles are low energies, right? Well, at the threshold, right?
Well, sure, that's where most of the particles are, but that's where most of the background is too. I mean,
it's not at the PV, basically.
If that's their background and this is the thing they're constraining, obviously it's this part that they're going to be most sensitive to, right?
Yeah, but this is not 3 PV. This is 10
TeV.
What are you basically sticking out? Right?
Well,
let's just look at the detection that they made, and that's something we already heard about from Carlos. Basically, IceCube has searched in the IC79, IC86 configuration with 2 years of data for high-energy neutrinos. What they've seen is 28 events, whereas you'd expect only 11 events. 7 of them are muon-like, 21 are cascade-like events. And that corresponds to 4.3 sigma excess over the standard atmospheric backgrounds, even if you play around with charm and you have a prompt contribution that would only give you 2 more background events. So there's definitely an excess. And the question is now, where do these neutrinos come from? They say it's consistent with a hard e to minus 2.2 spectrum, which isn't that far away from our e to minus 2.4 spectrum, which we got from the supernova remnants and gamma rays. And what I find most remarkable is the cutoff at few PV. Basically, if there wasn't a cutoff, they should have seen many more neutrinos at much higher energy. That's probably also basically answering your question why the 10 TeV range is probably the most important one. And the
TeV range is most important?
Well, that's where you have the best statistics, right? That's what's most constraining to your fit.
Any excess of 10 TeV.
I'm sorry, you're right, 100 TV.
No, the background's way too big, so you don't see anything until you get to
no,
about 100.
No, you're right.
Yeah. We're at 100, basically. But I mean, what that really looks like to me is some galactic contribution. Basically, it's cutting off at a few PV, which you've seen in hadronic cosmic rays. That's basically the first knee. Some people believe that's the cutoff of the galactic accelerators.
Hang on, a PV cosmic ray gives you a much lower energy neutrino. So this means 100 PeV cosmic rays are making the PeV.
That depends really what your primary species is. For protons, it's not necessarily cutting off at the knee, but below the knee, right? Let's just...
Yeah, I don't see how a PeV neutrino can come from anything galactic.
I think that seems implausible to me.
No,
okay. I don't know where they come from.
Why should any extragalactic source then cut off a neutrinos at a PV?
Which is there are lots of models that have, you know, peaks around a PV for AGN and Universe and starburst galaxies. And that starburst galaxies are supposed to, they're known to cut off a PV in the models, for example. To make a PV neutrino, a nucleon has to hit a nucleon, and that first nucleon has to have 100 or so PV energy. And there's just no 100 PV nucleons accelerated in the galaxy, right?
How do you know that, if not from neutrinos?
I mean, just from like Hillis criterion sort of things, or just there aren't any sources with the main criteria.
Well, you know, some people are arguing that the transition between galactic source and exogalactic source actually happening at the ankle, basically at this tip. Which of course is putting a lot of stress on the source models, right?
Those are iron nuclei there, right? That's mm-hmm. the only thing that can reach that. So you really need to get a nuclei and divide that by 56. Mm-hmm. Now you don't make it.
No, if you go up to the ankle, of course. You divide the ankle by 56, and then again by a factor of 10 or a few, and then you have the PV.
It's not a few, it's 100. So now we're talking about a factor of 5,000. 5,000 PV is 50 EV, and that's above the ankle.
But that's exactly the same problem for extragalactic sources. I mean, ion sources, extragalactic ion sources, right? Exactly the same kinematics.
Except that in some extragalactic sources, they have the Hills criterion allows them to get much higher energy.
That's the only thing.
There are no AG in gamma ray bursts in our.
That's the only thing why you believe in a low crossover, right? The Hills criterion.
So,
of course, what IceCube has said, it's very unlikely that all these neutrinos coming from a single point source. Of course, they might come from several point sources. I mean, that's something which, as far as I understand, they haven't tested yet, or they haven't really put some results out. What I just did is, on the back of the envelope, just take the diffuse flux, which this would correspond to, integrated over the whole sky, and see what the total integrated flux is and how many sources I would need, or at what distances these sources would need to sit. So one source is, of course, ruled out, but you can, of course, just have two sources at 370 parsec. That would give you exactly the total integrated flux. And, of course, you can play that a number of times, and you can have five sources at a kiloparsec or something like that, a few hundred parsec or something like that. Of course, this isn't a sound result. It's just a hint that at least some of these neutrinos could come from galactic sources if you have the high crossover scenario. Now, I think
the galactic center of this plot is this.
It's right here. Could come from the galactic center. Could be sources in the galactic center direction in a local, in the nearby spiral arm. So I think I've already saturated my time. I haven't come to talking about Fermi bubbles. It's very difficult giving you the upshot of our model in a minute. Not sure what I shall do. If people want to know about the Fermi bubbles, come talk to me. I'm still here next week, or shall I just plow on?
I think we're 15 minutes over, so I think it's a good time to stop here.
Fair enough.
If you had one more slide you want to show, it'd be fun, but I think we can talk to you independently about the bubbles.
Absolutely, yeah. Do come and talk to me about the bubbles. Thank you very much.
Thank you.